I am Laura Snail of the Oral History Project of the University of Wisconsin. I am going to be interviewing Hugh Richards of the Physics Department in his office in Sterling Hall. This is Thursday, January 6, 1977. To begin with, Professor Richards, would you tell me where you were born and when and brought up, where you went to school?
I was born in the Dust Bowl area in Colorado, actually, the southeastern section. My father had homesteaded a ranch in this area. I was born November 7th, 1918. And although we lived there for several years, after the war, the price of cattle had dropped where my father couldn't support a family in the Dust Bowl country. And he had originally been an electrical engineer teaching at Pratt Institute in Brooklyn, New York, and so he got back into teaching, finally getting a job at what was the Wisconsin State School of Mines at Platteville, Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. And that's when I came to Wisconsin, which was about 1923, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
I was, you know, four or five. My birthday is such that I think I was actually four at the time. And so I grew up in Platteville, Wisconsin, where my father taught at the State School of Mines, taught physics and calculus. After high school, I went to college at Park College, a small liberal arts school near Kansas City, Missouri, Parkville, Missouri, where my parents had gone, and majored in physics there. And for graduate work, I very nearly came to Wisconsin. I had an offer from Wisconsin and Minnesota, but I went to Rice University at Houston, Texas, primarily because my father had been in ill health and had to retire and had moved down to Louisiana. And it looked like the best place to be close to my mother and father at that time. So my graduate work was at Rice University. One reason I went to Rice was because in my high school, my college course in physical chemistry was a book by University of Wisconsin, Getman and Daniels, for Farrington Daniels, and they had in it a description of electrostatic accelerator built by Professor Herb, which fascinated me. And I knew that Rice University had just completed a copy of Ray Herb's electrostatic accelerator, and it looked like a good opportunity to get in on the ground floor on that development. And also I had heard very good reports about Professor H.A. Wilson, who ran the Rice Department. And I was very fortunate. That was a good choice. I got immediately interested in nuclear physics research there with this accelerator, working with Professor Bonner. My first experiments were on a measurement of neutron spectra using recoiling hydrogen nuclei and photographic emulsions, which recoiled from the neutron bombardment. And I developed this to considerable precision as a means of measuring neutron spectra. In my first publications, my master's thesis and PhD thesis all involved this neutron spectra.
What study. Year is this now?
I went to Rice in the fall of 1939, and I've completed my PhD in 1942, but actually the last half year I had been involved already in war activities. My major professor Bonner had gone to MIT to work on radar.
His first name is?
Tom Bonner. Mm-hmm. And he wished me to come there to work on radar work when I finished, but About a half semester before I finished, we were contacted by Bright, who was at the University of Wisconsin then, to do work on studying the neutron spectrum of neutrons from uranium fission as part of the it was OSRD project at that time, but later to become Manhattan District mm-hmm. project.
Now, when you say we, you mean the whole the whole physics department, or just your?
Well, it was one major professor, the major professor who was still left, and myself. Mm. Or just two people were involved on it. Mm-hmm. And so, the last semester of my graduate career, I spent the daytime working on the OSRD neutron spectrum measurement project. They were also interested in the neutron spectrum of from deuterons bombarding carbon, because that was the source of neutrons that they wished to use to study fission properties. And so all day I worked on that, and at night I finished up my thesis work. And when we finished, and got my degree in June, I went full-time on the OSRD project at Rice, and we completed the measurements that we could do there about October of 1942. It concerns how much we knew about the bomb project. At the start, we only knew that presumably the Germans were working on it, and that there was a possibility of it being something of importance in this war, and we felt a great sense of urgency that we explore it to the limit of our capability, and it was very high priority on that. The information sharing in general was quite adequate in most of the contacts I had with the project. Well, in October then, when we finished the task at Rice, they asked us to go up to the University of Minnesota to help John Williams, Professor Williams up there, complete some experiments on scattering of neutrons. And so I went from Houston to Minneapolis, but we stopped by the University of Chicago on the way up for briefings there with Professor Teller and John Manley, particularly about the project. And this was shortly before the chain reacting pile had and gone critical successfully at Chicago, but we knew about it.
Yeah. Were they already in that big building that they had?
The pile was made in Sag Field, but the offices and the metallurgical project, as it was called, was at the University of Chicago buildings proper. Mm-hmm. And so at that time, we went on up to Minnesota, and I continued some more neutron spectrum studies of fission neutrons, and helped with the total neutron cross-section measurements on various scattering materials, carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, and also uranium. And during that winter, we heard, well, we knew that there was to be a central laboratory set up to coordinate the work and push for the final bomb development, and we had great speculations about where it was to be. In fact, we had a betting pool on it, but we'd been misled concerning where Oppenheimer's interests lay on it, and none of us came very close to it. But in April of that year, we moved down to Los Alamos to continue the work. And in fact, at that time, well, the Los Alamos Ranch School for Boys was just moving out. We were essentially some of the first people there. And in fact, there wasn't housing for us at first. In the first couple of weeks, we had to live in dude ranches down in the Santa Fe area and commute up to Los Alamos. And that time I first met Professor Mack from the University of Wisconsin, who had come down via Princeton. He was in charge of a lot of the optical work. And pretty soon we were able to live up in one of the boys' dormitories at Los Alamos Ranch School. And we were concerned mainly at the start in, of course, getting laboratories constructed, and the two accelerators from the University of Wisconsin were being moved down to the laboratory, and we were involved in getting those set up and running.
Would you want to say something about that? Did it actually happen in the middle of the night that they were taken from here?
Well, I wasn't involved in the removal.
You didn't know the details.
Here, I doubt whether it was the middle of the night, but
I heard that from somebody.
It may have been Professor Herb.
Well, no, not from him.
No. At any rate, our first task was to get these accelerators set up and going, and I got acquainted with the Wisconsin group. Professor Herb was not with it because he was tied up with MIT, and Joe McKibben was the one who was heading the group, and the rest were graduate students or recent PhDs. And I was quite impressed with the caliber of the Wisconsin group and their ability to do things and devise and make equipment and have it operate.
I'd like to ask you two questions. Do you think Herb regretted not being there?
Oh, I'm sure he did, yes, yes. But John Williams from Minnesota, who worked with accelerators also, took over the direction of the accelerator, lecture study accelerator.
And the other one is what hours you were working?
We worked all 3 hours that we could. We didn't punch clocks. There wasn't much else to do.
I just wondered if it seems as if it must have been a tremendously exciting time.
It certainly was. There was a great deal of enthusiasm. It was an especially young group. There were, and vigorous then, lots of energy. And we worked many long hours regularly. And we got the accelerators back together in an operation and started on the various measurements and programs that were our task. I remember, for example, one time the world's total supply of plutonium, which was 140 micrograms, which had been made by cyclotron bombardment, we had for 2 weeks' time in order to measure the number of neutrons per fission from plutonium. And we worked essentially nearly as around the clock as we could for 2 weeks, all of us on that project, and we succeeded in our measurements. We did get a little vacation after that. We went over to the Pecos River in the Sangre de Cristo Mountains and took several days vacation to recuperate. But it was very fascinating work, and the people with whom you associated were the world's greatest physicists of the time. Enrico Fermi was there, and Niels Bohr came later, and the caliber of the physicists there was just outstanding. Hans Bethe, Guy Weisskopf, and Dick Feynman, who later Nobel Prize winner. So it was indeed a very stimulating period. Well, I, besides the regular measurements with the machines which we were involved, neutron cross sections, I also continued neutron spectrum studies, particularly uranium fission, which they were interested in. And when the time for production of quantities of material large enough for testing developed, the laboratory was short of really staff to do the testing and measurements involved, and so our basic physics research was postponed, and we were reassigned jobs on the testing involved. I was in charge of the measurements of neutrons from the first test, and Professor Barshall, who was at Los Alamos too, and now on the University of Wisconsin staff, was in charge of a good many of the blast measurements. And we had a preview of the first bomb test in May of 1945, I think it was, yeah. And that time we set off 100 tons of TNT and to test blast gauges and so forth to simulate and scale things for the bigger test. And the big test was scheduled in July. And we also found that a great many of the field conditions for electrical signals and so forth were more difficult than had been first anticipated. But in fact, Joe McKibben from Wisconsin was the one in charge of all the timing and signals on both tests and did a tremendous job on it. Deserves a great deal of credit. On the final test, the group that I had on neutron measurements included measurements from some balloons, helium filled balloons, where we had recording instruments, and also some ground station recording instruments which measured neutrons as a function of time. And also radioactivity measurements in various distances. The object of our measurements was primarily to serve as diagnostic tools in case the detonation did not go as anticipated, and one had to find out why the implosion wasn't successful in the detonation. And so actually most of our records were destroyed because the test was quite successful, and so the close-up instruments and most of the balloon things didn't give much useful information. But we were allowed to go in. We took 5 Rentgen radiation dose to go in, pick up equipment and records afterwards, and we did have good enough records so that we could plot the neutron intensity at more distant stations as a function of time, and made measurements of the the efficiency fraction of the energy which was available, converted. The bomb, we for the bomb explosion test itself, we were about, it was about 10 miles away at the McDonald Wrench house, and it was very spectacular event that occurred, of course, there. That's been described
Yes, many times, it has, although it's...
It was also a very sobering thing, and a great many of us were active for many years afterwards in setting up first a group of scientists at Los Alamos, Association of Los Alamos Scientists, called ALAS, and then the Federation of American Scientists, to try to alert the public and the world to the problems which this new control over nature posed for mankind, and the hope that it might mean the end of warfare as we traditionally knew it, if the mankind would recognize the that a new dimension has been added, and that war as an instrument of national policy, in a sense, was becoming obsolete. And we pushed for international control of atomic energy, and unsuccessfully, but this was the start of a good deal of this science organization. And after Los Alamos, I had offers to go to both Princeton and to Illinois for physics programs, but the Wisconsin program looked like the best bet as far as I was concerned. I'd worked with the accelerators from Wisconsin. I was impressed with the caliber of the students and staff that involved at Wisconsin, and so I accepted the research associateship appointment and came back and brought the one of the accelerators back to Wisconsin. The other one was purchased by Los Alamos and kept there. And the next year then, next winter, I was involved in the installation of return of the long tank here, and I came permanently in May of that year, 1946, and I've been here ever since. Our first job was to get the accelerators running and producing again, and Professor Herb was back at that time, and Professor Barshall had joined the staff from Los Alamos, and we three were the ones who started the program after the war, plus a great many of students who had been at Los Alamos from Wisconsin who came back, finished their PhDs at that time.
How many are you speaking of, about?
Oh, there were of students, half a dozen perhaps. Mm-hmm. I don't know offhand.
Was this a particularly large contingent from a university, or were how many other universities were sending?
Well, at Los Alamos, there was the Wisconsin group with the accelerators. There was a group from Minnesota, which involved two or three students, came down with Professor Williams and myself. There was a group from Princeton, which Bob Wilson, who heads Fermilab now, ran. The cyclotron had been brought from Harvard, and he ran that group. And there were, in physics, some from California, in chemistry, there were people from various places, Columbia and particularly California in chemistry. Some of the larger groups were, in physics, were the Wisconsin and, actually the group at Princeton came from other places too. They'd been assembled there first, mm-hmm. and the people from Ohio State and Cornell and various mm-hmm. other places. But the actual contribution of the Wisconsin group at Los Alamos was very large. Most of the really precision data which was needed came from the electrostatic accelerators rather than the cyclotrons. Educated a lot of people to the importance of the electrostatic accelerators.
Did Herb get proper credit for that? Because he developed them.
Herb was both nationally and internationally recognized, I think, for it, and deservedly so.
Mm-hmm.
He a most unusual person. Well, maybe this is a good time to reminisce a little about Ray.
I'm just curious about one thing. You say you came back with one of the electrostatic accelerators.
Yeah.
How big was it?
It was a tank about 6.5 feet in diameter, if I remember. At least it's the width of the windows in Sterling Hall, because it had the old part of Sterling Hall.
He mentions that. It had
not determined the size of it. It was about 28 some feet long.
You must have had it in a truck then.
Oh, it was riggers, movers brought it, but we just had to reinstall it.
Yeah.
It was quite a job actually getting it up the hill at Los Alamos. The riggers had hairpin turns to go around and so forth. It was an interesting rigging job. But I came back because I've been particularly impressed by Herb's program. First, that story in the physical chemistry book about his accelerator at Wisconsin, and then the Rice one, which was a copy of it, and Professor Bonner's high opinion of Herb in Wisconsin and Gregory Bright particularly. And I was not disappointed. I was very pleased with the Wisconsin group. And my admiration for Professor Herb increased even more. I might tell some stories about Ray, which he may not have given on his interview. He came of a farm family up near Appleton, Wisconsin, Neverino, I believe it was. And he told me once that he almost didn't go on to high school because it wasn't a common thing for the farm boys to go to high school at that time. But he decided he wanted to play football, and so he decided to go to high school to play football. Well, he was too small to really be a successful football player, but in high school he did discover himself and came on to the university.
That's wonderful.
Where I guess he essentially earned his own way through both undergraduate and then, of course, he had support for graduate work. But there was another story about Ray which I think is interesting to relate. I asked him once about why he came back to Wisconsin from MIT, because he certainly had many offers elsewhere, both radar work and otherwise, and I wondered why he came back to Wisconsin. And he said, told me a story. He said when he first went to MIT, he was extremely impressed by the quality of the lab technicians that MIT had. This was electronic wiring up circuits, debugging them. Just really remarkable technicians. And he said the other thing that impressed him about MIT, the radiation lab, this was the war work on radar, was that the overwhelming predominance of Midwesterners in the physics, science, and engineering positions. And it said it took him a while to, he said it took him a while to put two and two together and realize that these two phenomena were connected, that if these lab technicians had not been born in around Massachusetts, Boston area, but had been born in the Midwest, they would have been scientists and physicists and engineers, but in the Eastern, without the good, cheap public higher education, they had no chance to go on. They couldn't afford to go to Harvard or MIT, and it was the good, cheap, available public higher education in the Midwest that made the difference for the conversion of talented people into scientists and engineers. And he said he felt a responsibility to pay back this investment which the state had made in him. And in the same connection, in his development of accelerators, he found that many of his innovations and developments were exploited commercially by Eastern concerns, for example, high voltage engineering company. And as a consequence, he felt it was sort of bad for the Midwest because the commercial exploitation of these were on the coasts rather than where they'd been developed. And I think that is back of the reason why he finally started his own company, so that he could keep some of these developments in the Middle West, and so that the people graduating didn't have to go to the East Coast to the West Coast to find jobs. But there are other reasons too, but I'm sure this was not a unimportant factor in his starting of his company. I thought he was completely crazy when he started the company, because it was a time when federal support of research was declining, and certainly the number of new accelerators which the government would support seemed to be going to zero, and in fact did almost go to zero. And I didn't see how he could possibly compete against the established concerns which were having trouble already. But his leadership, both scientific and business-wise, was such that he did compete successfully and has become the dominant accelerator concern in this area. You want to shut it off for a minute? My initial appointment with Wisconsin was as a research associate, and I spent full time trying to get the experimental program going, involved equipping the labs and getting students started on thesis programs. Our research program in nuclear physics here has always been primarily one of student theses work. There's been very little research done which hasn't been directly related to student theses, and I think this is different in some places where the research may be not directly related to educational program. But here in physics in general, nuclear physics in particularly, there is really no distinction, has been no distinction between graduate education and instruction and research. They're integral, one and the same thing. Question?
I'm trying to, would this be true in the other science departments here, or is it
I think it is true in a great many of the science departments, but in varying degrees, I suspect. I think it may be less true in, I shouldn't speak outside, I don't really know, but in physics, it is certainly true that most of the research, it's less so in high energy physics, but in nuclear physics and most of the other physics, it's been primarily student education. Mm-hmm. I think Wisconsin perhaps has had a larger fraction of the physics research directly related to student theses and graduate education than many other places, where more of the work was either professors' individual research or postdocs or research personnel hired for that purpose. But I think this is a feature which is often neglected when the charges are made at the university that universities in research rather than instruction or teaching. In my experience with the work in the physics department, most of the research is inseparable from the graduate teaching function. On my own history then, after initial appointment as a research associate, I was asked to help out on the teaching. The staff was very small at that time, and the teaching load was increasing enormously with the veterans coming back to school. And so I became an assistant professor and taught courses. The teaching loads initially in that period were very high compared to now, although I did get somewhat lightened load often because of trying to get the experimental program going here, and Professor Herb and Barshall also did too. But I do know that Professor Barshall in particular taught quite a heavy load the number
of times. Could you say what were you teaching? How many hours?
Well, I don't remember the exact number of hours, but I was teaching one of the major introductory physics courses with the lab and quiz sections too.
With how many students?
Varied from year to year how many students, but you had TA as assistants to help on the handling the and lab and quiz sections. My load was lighter, I think, than some of the others.
Would you have an average of 50 or 100 or 200? In the beginning?
It varied from classes. The engineering classes had several hundred. The high level physics, introductory physics course was a smaller group, but I think it had, it ranged from 50 to 100, I suspect. Something.
But you didn't have anything to do with the engineering course?
We teach a course for introductory physics for engineering,
oh,
and
I did
teach that sometimes, and also there was an electricity and magnetism course for electrical engineers that I taught one time, I know, but well, it's ordinary teaching in that respect. But I did have a number of graduate students who finished and did well and are, made names for themselves since. But we were always extremely short of staff in the physics department to handle both our undergraduate teaching responsibilities and our graduate teaching responsibilities, which were the student theses. And the university administration was extremely conservative on allowing expansion of physics staff, particularly They were worried about the softness of the research support money. At that time, it was, we were some of the first, one of the first places to get, in fact, our AEC contract was the first general research contract that the AEC gave, and it's still the longest in operation of any of the, it's now IRTA, but the AEC contracts. But the fact that we could get this outside support didn't carry much weight with either Dean Ingram or the university administration on adding staff positions. And so it was each semester a terrific bind to find enough staff to cover the undergraduate teaching assignments and still find enough staff to supervise the graduate student theses, which were, the graduate enrollment was way up too.
Now, so when you said the first to receive, do you mean the first department in the university to receive
a... First in the country. We have the oldest AEC, unrestricted, unclassified general research contract.
But that's for physics departments?
Yes.
But in relation to other departments in the university that, say, Dean Ingram would have been dealing with, is it that he was not yet ready to...
Well, I think they considered this a temporary sort of thing, and Dean Ingram particularly didn't want to favor one department over another, and he was reluctant to... Well, there are two problems. One is a reluctance to have competitive salaries and recruiting, I guess. I think that was perhaps the biggest handicap. I think he would have let us add perhaps more staff, but at the salary levels at that time, which he would permit, which physics were the same as the rest of the universities, we couldn't get the people we wanted often. But both factors were involved, both the salary level and the difficulty in getting new positions. Now, part of this was a wise policy because some places overexpanded on soft money, but I think we went too far the other way.
And of course that's happened since here, that some departments have overexpanded. But the university was just beginning to cope with soft money, is that right? It would be
yes.
About the first experience.
Yes, in fact this first contract that we had with the AEC, the AEC had asked about the overhead part on it, and the university's initial position was they didn't want to charge any overhead because the AEC would be helping university do what they would be doing anyway. We'd been supported some by WARF on our initial step in getting going, and the initial attitude was there. No point of overhead, we just use
yes,
it all for the contract.
Mm-hmm.
But it gradually, I think they gradually, I believe originally they accepted about 8% overhead on it. Of course it's risen now to where overhead and fringe benefits amount to about over 70% of the salary support. So that is a change with time. And the university for many years did have exceptionally low overhead charges compared to many other places. But the only way we could manage in the early days was to use the IRTA support to actually pay our salaries for semester leaves in order to handle the graduate students and keep the program going. But finally, there was some expansion of staff slowly. But there was still strong feeling that the university was not in a competitive salary bracket with other institutions which were competing for talent, and we were at one time faced with possible wholesale exit of 4 or 5 of our top, at that time was theory and high energy people. And Ingram, who was dean at that time, was apparently reluctant to make really competitive matching offers to keep them. There was a great deal of unhappiness in the department about this, and actually I believe, I'm not certain whether it was at this time or not, I was on the Physical Science Divisional Committee, and the Physical Science Divisional Committee was took steps to point out publicly the danger to the university of not being competitive and salary-wise, and at least in the sciences, that we were in real danger of losing a large fraction of our top scientists.
Now, you could have had the money from the from other sources than the university, so.
But you can only pay the salaries that the university authorizes, and
yes.
And the university, of course, has a long time commitment on the salaries, and the object was to keep the salaries in physics the same as in English and history, mm-hmm. and so forth. And the way these things work, of course, is if in salaries in physics are allowed to rise, then the salaries in English and history go up too, but I think people were short-sighted in that regard, and there was reluctance to meet the outside competition for a long time. And in fact, we lost, I know one case when Rollison was chairman where he was trying to hire John Bardeen from Bell Telephone Labs. Bardeen had been an undergraduate here, and Bardeen Medical Lab, named after his father, who was dean of the medical school. And Bardeen had, in effect, was one of the co-discoverers of the transistor, and we were sure he was going to go ahead and get a Nobel Prize, but... the way these things work, of course, is if in salaries in physics are allowed to rise, then the salaries in English and history go up too, but I think people were short-sighted in that regard, and there was reluctance to meet the outside competition for a long time. And in fact, we lost, I know one case when Rollison was chairman where he was trying to hire John Bardeen from Bell Telephone Labs. Bardeen had been an undergraduate here, and Bardeen Medical Lab, named after his father, who was dean of the medical school. And Bardeen had, in effect, was one of the co-discoverers of the transistor, and we were sure he was going to go ahead and get a Nobel Prize, but and he would have come here from Bell Telephone Labs, I'm pretty sure, except the maximum salary in the university, which the administration would allow to be offered, was less than his sister was earning as an anesthetologist, and he went to the University of Illinois, and this is the sort of thing that we felt just greatly frustrated. One could have added top-rate people if we could have only been competitive at all salary-wise.
Now, this was in the 50s, then.
I suspect so. I'd have to check the times, but yeah. Certainly was in the 50s, I think.
Because the lid did come off then, didn't it, or not?
Well, I'll get to some of that. Professor Rollison was chairman during good share of this, and he had, I think, extremely good judgment on handling people and choosing people. He was not perhaps as aggressive in pushing the physics department as at least a good many people in the physics department thought that he should be. And there, as a result, I think became an organized opposition to him. I hadn't realized all this at this time because I wasn't really involved in departmental politics, But Rollison, I think, took leave to go to one of these government jobs. Maybe it was chief scientist of the Army or something like this. And the department asked me to become chairman. And I hadn't realized at the time how much of it was sort of in opposition to Rollison not perhaps being aggressive enough in, with the dean and the administration in pushing salaries. I had been pushing this in the divisional committee earlier, and this may have been the reason. I don't know what the reason for the department chose me.
Would you want to say more about that period on the divisional committee? That is, were the other departments willing to
Well, it was a common problem in a good many departments, and I know there was a great support in the divisional committee for the university taking a more realistic view on what they would have to do to retain and recruit to keep the department strong. Mm-hmm. And Elvin was president at that time, and I think he realized some of it, but in the L&S College, I think Dean Ingram was the conservative one who was very careful that he had to keep the salaries in English and physics and history all the same, or something like this, and which made it difficult.
When you say you made it public, you mean you have put something in the newspapers? Or?
Yes, we had resolutions on it and statements on it. But I would have to check records on some of this to be more specific. This is
Fred was here, was president until 1958.
Well, that, that was late 58, because I think
Elvin was 58 to 62. Mm-hmm.
I think maybe it was shortly after Elvin. I don't know, I'd have to check. Maybe Fred was still on. Fred was involved on the Bardeen thing, I know. He was president at that time. Elvin was involved on some of the divisional activities. I've forgotten mm-hmm. dates, so I don't know the order of these. I have to check records to see.
Did you ever actually go and talk to Fred or?
I didn't at that
committee?
Time. I think when I was divisional committee, I think that was when Elvium was, I'm pretty sure Elvium was the one who appointed me, I think. Mm-hmm. Although I could be wrong on this, but my dealings, as I recall, were all with Elvium.
Did you go to him? Did the committee go to him?
I don't remember the details on this. It's been a long time, and I haven't reviewed this, so I didn't want to say on. I could look up in records, probably. I think I have some correspondence with Elvium on some of it. At any rate, as department chairman, well, the two biggest needs of the department were both staff and the other thing was space. The physics department was exceptionally crowded here. We only had initially the basement and first couple of floors of Sterling, and we finally got additional space and some temporary buildings for some of the labs, but conditions were really atrocious until this east wing of this building was built in 1958. I had only an inside office without windows, which had been a cubbyhole storeroom, and conditions on crowding were just intolerable. And this was another, I think, friction in the department that the department had not been given space expansion commensurate with its needs. And I think Ingram probably is at fault in part of this. The university was having a building program, and L&S was the largest single college on the university, but most of the new buildings didn't go to L&S. They went to law school and engineering and ag and various other places. And the only building I know of that Ingram really pushed for was the library. Mm-hmm. And the department felt particularly frustrated on space because they want, presumably, chemistry had to get space first, and our expansion was to be where chemistry had been. And this just looked like it would never occur. And I know one of my big objectives as chairman was to push the space problem to get more space for the department as well as the salary bit. On the space problem, one thing where we could have gotten money at one time but were essentially frustrated by the administration was that we had proposed to NSF for a building covering Lathrop Drive going on to chemistry, because you see, until chemistry moved, we couldn't get that space, and this would be a way to get space before that, having a building covering that than a high-rise one. And we had drawn up plans for this on our own and got a site visit from NSF, but Kurt went and the administration essentially torpedoed us on it. We heard later from some of the NSF site people that they were all for it, approving it, but the administration said it couldn't be built there and they wouldn't permit it or something. And so this was another frustration that we could have gotten NSF money for the building at that time, but instead, I think the engineering research building was built or something like this. Now, Elvium was also sympathetic to our space problems, and he, in fact, urged me to ask for the site across Charter and Linden, where Van Hise now is, and that would be close enough so physics could expand there and not have to wait for chemistry to get a building. But I indeed sold the department on that approach, that would be close enough space, and we went to the campus planning committee to get authorization for that site, and the campus planning committee turned it down largely because of Harrington, who wanted that space for humanities. And
he was dean then, is that right?
I think he was, I don't know what his, he wasn't dean, but he had some.
He was never dean.
He was never dean. I think he was had some
vice president. He was vice president,
I guess.
Yeah.
Now, I was told by Harvard Campus Planning Committee that it was Harrington who opposed that. I don't know whether Elvium hadn't pushed it hard enough or what, but that essentially torpedoed any chance of expansion that way. Now, Rollison, when he was chairman, had gotten money from Wharf for expansion this wing here, and we had great hopes that we could expand in this direction. The money from Wharf initially was just enough for the basement and first floor here, and this would enable us to get room for a new accelerator here, which we were interested in nuclear physics. But when that was authorized, then the math department got in on the act, and the math research center was being talked about, and they insisted on adding three stories for it, and then somebody wanted the old observatory for an office building. And so they got astronomy out and put them on fifth and sixth floors, and the result was this completely blocked physics expansion this way. Physics didn't want math here, astronomy wanted that for physics expansion, so so we were completely tied up this way. We were quite unhappy with the Math Center being here. In particular, it later hurt us too, in that Math had originally had a site south of University Avenue for their building, but then because the Math Center was here, they decided that they had to be close to it, and they abandoned that and insisted on building Van Vleck close by because of the Math Center and because Math Physics Library was integral unit too. And so this still frustrated physics on expansion space. And it wasn't indeed until chemistry finally got space, and it was largely through push from physics, I guess, that they got space and finally high enough on the priority list to get a building, that physics got support for additional space. It isn't quite as bad as I made it in some respect, because of course as other buildings were built, some of the other occupants of Sterling left, and we did get small increments of space in Sterling. The first Commerce Department moved out of the fourth floor of Sterling and built their business school, and so that gave some more space in Sterling. And then finally, when social studies, econ, and the difficulty on building for L&S was not due to the legislature. I think it was lack of aggressive enough L&S dean. In fact, when Young became dean, conditions were turned around in that respect. I think part of it also reflects the disadvantage of having one large college, which is larger than most universities, with just one dean, because on most administrative committees and campus planning and so forth, there tends to be representative by deans of colleges, and dean of the law school, which had a faculty no bigger than the physics department itself, would tend to be represented, and the small colleges have an intrinsic advantage in this respect. Now, actually, Professor Barshall and myself worried about this considerable length, and we tried to sell the administration on the need and advantage of splitting the Letters and Science College into smaller colleges, not only for that reason, but because, in fact, it is humanly impossible for any dean in the Letters and Science College to be on top of the individual problems in departments. He has somewhere close to 40 departments and schools, various things,
institutes
he worries about, and he can't even know the staff, really. If he can remember the names of all the chairmen, he's doing well. And in such a circumstance, it's our opinion that the dean cannot, in fact, exercise effective leadership, and that the college is simply too large to be functional in that respect. It was our objection on this, which I guess triggered Young, when he became dean, to having associate deans for humanities and science and so forth. That's I think was his reaction to this, which helped somewhat. And Ed Young was exceptional in getting around and knowing departments and their problems. He's one of the few deans who ever came to a building and went through it and looked at space problems, and interviewing staff, he would come down here and interview them rather than take them up there. And I think he was in closer touch with what the problems were than most deans have been. But I think it's still intrinsically a problem, and that the Letters and Science College is too big to be functional. Now, Ed Young managed successfully as dean largely because at that time it was a time of rapid expansion and there was money available and he could give chairman essentially what they wanted. The crisis comes when hard decisions have to be made on allocation of resources, and I think under the present circumstance there is humanly impossible for a dean of LNS to really exercise very much intelligent judgment on how court cuts should be made and so forth. He can either treat everyone the same 10% cut or a certain fractional thing, but it's just not possible to have the first-hand judgment about things which would be possible in a smaller college. Yeah. And I think there's still need for such a split up of the college into smaller units.